Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Yakir Englander, your host today. Today we will speak with Michael Manekin, who wrote the book In the Dawn of Redemption, Ethics and Tradition in a Time of Power. Michael argues that modern Jewish nationalism, widespread today among secular as well as religious Israeli Jews, is incompatible with traditional Jewish ethics. Manekin, an Orthodox religious Jew and anti-occupation activist, draws on traditional texts as well as his own family history in an attempt to reconcile a religious ethical system created in the diaspora with the political reality of a modern nation state. He argues that Jewish ethics, grounded in a long-time religious tradition, can fuel and guide critically minded, politically engaged citizens. Specifically, Manekin argues that the Jewish tradition denounces a desire for power and control, as well as ideologies of ethnic superiority. The author, Michael Manekin, our guest, is the director of the Alliance Fellowship Program, a network of Arab and Jewish progressive leaders in Israel. Before running the Alliance, Michael served as the director of Molad, a non-partisan progressive think tank in Jerusalem, focused on demographic change in Israel. Prior to that, Michael was the executive director of Breaking the Silence, an Israeli military veterans group focused on educating the public as to the results of military control of the West Bank and Gaza. He lives in Jerusalem with his wife, Yael, and their children, Ruth, Sarai, and Noach. Michael, thank you so much for coming to the New Book.
Thank you.
So, your book starts with a very personal confession. You start with a story about your military service and a very interesting human moment, right? It's like event of a moment. It's not about what you did as a soldier, but what you did as a Michael, as a Jew, with your Jewish values, and something happened to you in a moment, very intimate personal moment in your service at the IDF. And I wonder if you can start there a little bit about what happened and why it shaked you so much. And also, why did you choose to start the book with that moment, with the personal story?
Okay. So, the book begins indeed with a reflection of a moment I had in the military service. I served for 4 years in the military, which is an extra time. I signed on extra as an officer, and I served in the infantry during the Second Intifada. I begin the
Which is the second Palestinian rebel, right?
Yes, it's right. We're talking about, I served from 1998 till 2002, and this is I guess sometime in 2000 or 2001, in the Nablus area. we were stationed to take hold of a house, which is a common procedure in the military. You take over a house because those are usually of Palestinians. Those houses become sort of makeshift bases and lookout points. With the family living nearby or next door, in this case, they were next door. The story I tell is of a moment where I went out of the house to relieve myself, to go to the bathroom. It's odd to talk about it. as I took down my pants, suddenly I noticed there was the owner of the house was an elderly woman who was standing in front of me. And there wasn't a vocal interaction between us. But there was a look, which I remember as a look of sort of disgust towards me. In the book, I say how, you know, I'm Orthodox. I wear a kippah, but it was under a helmet. So basically, I'm the only one who knows that I'm a religious individual. But I felt there's a phrase in Hebrew or a Jewish phrase, which is sort of a desecration of name and of God. And I felt that that's what I was doing, that I was desecrating his name. And that moment for me is a moment when I look back, when really the question of sort of my religious upbringing and my behavior, how did that mesh or how does that interact with questions of power and sometimes of grotesque power? Which is interesting. I actually ran once an organization called Breaking the Silence, which collects testimonies. And you were right to note that that's not a testimony that I would say in the organization. It's not a military story. It's not something which is problematic in terms of rules of engagement or in terms of international law. But that story, I think, was significant for me because there's something about sort of how the body how the body behaves in and how the body is seen and how the body sees its reality, which to me was very striking. The book is really an attempt to do, I guess, virtue ethics or Jewish virtue ethics in a time of power, or a very personal attempt. And, you know, a lot of times we think about virtue ethics as something which is very much cognitive, but I think it's much deeper than that. It's the way you behave as a person. And I think that's how, I think that's a very, I'm maybe other religions as well, but it's also a very Jewish way of looking at things. In terms of, you know, thinking about every aspect of your being how you speak, how your body behaves, how your mind behaves, and how it interacts. So it was a good, I thought it was a good sort of doorway into my thinking when I was writing the book.
Michael, I love that there is such an interesting connection inside the Jewish tradition between the moments when we are naked or when we are in a very intimate places, and then the images that come to us. There is a famous classical Jewish text about Joseph, that when he almost had intimate relationship with the Egyptian woman, he had the image of his father, Jacob, who was far, far away in Canaan, in Israel. And you also have all the time, walk with you in the book, the image of your Saba, of your grandpa, Yechiel, Michael, that I guess your name is coming from. And he's coming in 1949. And there is something between a tension between him as a dreamer, right? As a Zionist, Orthodox dreamer who pray for 2000 years. If I would take him as an image for the Jew in Europe, and he prayed to come to Jerusalem, and then he's coming. And yeah. I love that you capture the moments on the between, like when he's on the boat, when he's just having the first steps. And then we have you, Michael, the new generation, you know, of the Israelis, the Tzabar, the native, who is coming, and you have the sovereignty. Can you share a little bit about this tension?
Sure. I mean, so I write in the book, I didn't know him, and I know him through stories of my mother. But we did find the stories which I tell of him, most of them are him speaking or him writing, because we found letters, I guess drafts of letters, which he wrote really, you know, when he was on the boat to Israel, when he was a couple of weeks in. So I am named after him, and he was writing this when he was, you know, my age and in sort of a similar family circumstance, but also so different in terms of his life experiences. I mean, he was coming from a refugee camp, a displaced persons camp after, you know, after the Holocaust. And it's true that he was a Zionist, but I think it's a type of Zionism which is which we usually don't think about. He was not trying to build a new Jew. He was not, I think, very interested in sort of that secular nationalist version of Zionism, which is, you know, the hegemonic version of Zionism. His Zionism, I mean, at some point he compares his friends from the refugee camp moved to the U.S., which he calls the young woman, as opposed to Israel, which is the old mother, which is usually not the way that Zionists talk about Israel. And ultimately, I mean, I think he was very happy that he moved here, but also his idealized version of the state didn't really work with what ended up being here. And I write quite a bit about that as well. And I think he's constantly wrestling between, I mean, I read him as constantly wrestling between his incredible excitement to be part of this, you know, religious historical process, but also the fact that the reality isn't that way. And what I'm trying, what I was trying to do, and what I think I'm still trying to do, is try to tap into his understanding of Jewish ethics, because I think a lot of that has been forgotten, and it's been forgotten because it doesn't really work. Now, my book.
Can you say a little bit about what does it mean that it doesn't really work?
Yeah, sure. So I was about to say. I mean, I'm not. I think there is writing which is sort of a negation of the Israeli project, which is, you know, sort of diasporist. You know, there was an ethics of diaspora, which was one which was learned and one which was more timid, one which was more merciful. And that doesn't coincide at all with Israel. And therefore, you know, we shouldn't be part of this project. And I'm not exactly going in the route in that book because, I grew up here. I have a tremendous amount of empathy to that tradition. But I can't, it makes no sense for me to negate, nor do I want to both negate the Israeli, you know, project or romanticize too much the diasporist one. And my feeling was that it can't be that there is no way to tap into the ethos of, you know, the diasporist, let's call it ethos, without negating Israel. So the question for me is, how do I live as a Jew who's interested in continuing the tradition of my, you know, Eastern European family while still living in this country and recognizing the tremendous amount of power and privilege and also the abuse of power and privilege that Israeli Jews have here. And part of that for me meant not asking questions, which I don't feel I have much to offer, frankly, about sort of how should a Jewish state behave? Mm-hmm. I forgo that question from the get-go. I'm not interested in how the Jewish state should behave, because a state should behave like a state, democratic. I'm interested in how a Jew should behave in any state, in this case, how a Jew should behave in Israel. So the way for me to connect with the tradition that I am happily part of is to not try to transplant that tradition into the national ethos, but rather to build my, you know, my personal and my communal ethos and have a conversation, sometimes positive and sometimes negative, with the state.
So thank you. Thank you so much. So sure. What I would love to do now is to walk a few steps that I saw in your book. And I think that the first step is that you go back to some of the traditions or some of the texts in the Jewish tradition who speak about which kind of behavior is it we God or the Jewish culture, the Jewish tradition, religion expect from the Jew. And then you, for example, you say that in order to mimic the divine, in order to walk as a divine, that the Jewish classical text says that we need to walk with the actions of the divine, right? As the divine is merciful,
yeah,
we need to be merciful. And I would love if you can say a few words about that for listeners who are less experienced with Jewish texts. And also I wonder if you really think that these are the majority or the main voice in the Jewish tradition, or you think that there are also others that include some more harshness or power inside it?
Sure. I mean, so maybe I'll answer the second part first, which will make it easier to answer.
Yes, please, please.
So first of all, of course, this is one stream of tradition of Jewish thought, and I'm aware of that in the book as well, that I think any traditional individual, whether he's critical or not, ultimately chooses a version of the tradition which makes sense to his or her upbringing. And obviously I do that. I think religious Zionism definitely does that, and I show it in the book, ultra-Orthodox Jewry and so on. I don't think anybody can run away from it. The question is if you're aware that that's what you're doing or not. In my case, what I was particularly drawn to is a stream of Jewish tradition, which I do think is connected throughout history, which is a stream of virtue ethical literature, what's called Safrut Musar in Hebrew. And we have that tradition from Mishnaic times or from 2000 years ago up until today, where you have books which are dedicated to the behavior of the individual, or ethical texts which are dedicated to the behavior of the individual. And I would say even within that, I think there's a stream of what can be called Hasidic virtue ethics. Hasidic not in the sense of the Hasidic movement, which we know today, which is a sort of sociological phenomenon, but Hasidic in the books of pietists.
Yes.
And just to hammer the point in where this is only one stream of tradition, I think most of what pietistic books do is actually have arguments with other Jews. So, if you read the books of the German pietists in the Middle Ages, most of their back and forth and most of their anger is at the majority of the Jewish community, when they're very aware that they're in the minority. And those books are for me, very powerful. So too, Egyptian pietists or other books which I allude to in the book. So I do choose a version of that. There is definitely an element in all of these books mimicking the behavior of God. Yeah. Ultimately, I would say it's both of God and of our forefathers. Ultimately, there are ideal types, whether it's God or whether it's, famous rabbis, or in my case, my idealized grandfather. which I was very aware that that's in the position which I was putting him into in the book, which is asking, you know, let's see how they behave and how do we behave in that way. I think you're right to point out to that a lot of it is not only just in terms of how you think or how you feel, but a lot of it is about action. A lot of it is understanding what do you actually do on the ground. In the book, I talk quite a lot about, which I guess in a way is very sort of like conservative in the small C, the importance of, you know, mitzvot or commandments or understanding their dynamics with ethics. And understanding how that relates to power. In my case, the question is, if I'm a citizen or I'm a soldier, so there are those laws which are given to me by the states or those universalist understandings, but there's also another set of traditions and laws which I need to adhere to. And if they don't work within, you know, state, I actually need to be in conflict with the state. So that's in terms of those virtues. Maybe I would add into that I think those virtues and those actions don't work if there's an overarching story or telos. And for me, the question of, you know, diaspora and redemption and what does it mean? What does redemption mean in the Jewish context and in the Israeli context is very significant. I think a lot of Jewish thought, most Jewish thought, regarding Israel, sees Israel as an end to diaspora, which I think is theologically very problematic. Meaning from my, you know, religious understanding, I'm very much still in the diaspora because, you know, we're still living in what's called in rabbinic tradition, this world and not the next world.
Yeah, fascinating. So I just want to make sure that I understand. You say it's not that you want to go back to the diaspora, but you want to keep the dialogue, or what we will say in Aramaic, the chavruta, the learning together with the diaspora, where maybe Israel is a state, as a souvenir with sovereignty, they need to make decisions, you know, as a state, but we must continue the dialogue. And then in the book, you do two more steps, which were fascinating for me. One, and I would love if you can share some more about that. One, you said that David Ben-Gurion, as an example, the first prime minister of Israel, but who also had a deep ideology around what he did, he took the element of religion and he translated it to nationalism, if I understood. But yeah. Then you said there is one more step, which is the role of the Zionist orthodoxy in Israel, and mostly after 67, where they bring nationalism with power and religion together. So I wonder if you can walk us a little bit there.
Sure. So, I mean, and this relates to the previous point, because and maybe this is less understood outside of the country. Diaspora is a negative term in Israel. Diasporic ethics are considered negative. And that makes it very hard to be a traditional Jew. So I think what happened in sort of mainstream, you know, Zionism, particularly post 48, is that there was both a rebellion against the traditional Jewish world, but there was also an attempt to confiscate the language of traditional Jewry and use it for national purposes. And you see that everywhere, even today. I mean, even if you look at our flag, the Israeli flag is a secularized nationalist version of the tallit, of the prayer shawl that we wear. So basically, or, you know, the Knesset, our parliament, Knesset is a Jewish term. The fact that Jerusalem is the capital, everything is an attempt to take a traditional discourse and both rebel against it, but also to take hold of it and use it for nationalist purposes. So it's not, and make that, I wouldn't say make the state God, but make the people God. And I think, sadly, and over time, religious Jewry, religious Zionism, really fell into this mode of thinking, first apologetically, meaning religious Zionist rabbis, and I write about this in the book, you know, they weren't the ones deciding to go out into, you know, all of these military incursions of Israel, but they were the ones explaining afterwards, in retrospect, why this was done according to Jewish law, even if it wasn't. And over time, they became sort of the most vocal, coherent voices of the nationalization of religion. So it's not only that, you know, a lot of times if you read, definitely in the last couple of years, you'll read about Israel becoming more religious in the terminology and the politics. But I think there's another part for that, which is more frustrating for me as a religious individual, which is the nationalization of religion. So it's not only the, you know, religification of nationalism, but the nationalization of religion. And what I think is needed for me, I guess, is a separation of church and state in the deeper sense, which is to understand that religion needs to work, or the Jewish religion needs to work autonomously from the state in order to allow itself to continue putting, you know, God in the center and not the people or the state.
And I will say that the God that the Jewish tradition created, which is very different, I think, than the God of the Bible, which is sometimes very angry and sometimes, you know, has a lot of anger and also wish to revenge. But I think that maybe what you speak more is about the translation or the dialogue or the covenant of Jewish history with the divine, which is a divine which is much more feminine, sensitive. Is it right to say it like that?
Definitely both of those. I think sensitive is a really powerful word. So thank you. I would also say, two attitudes which can seem contradictory. One is responsible, but the other one is very hesitant. So it's something which is, demands, because the religion demands action, so it demands, you know, responsibility and a keen awareness of your surroundings, but also demands like a form of, you know, like a second thought, you know, like, I'm not sure. There's that attitude, which I think is so, you know, and definitely, you know, we're living through this very populist period, which I think is defined more than it's defined by aggression. It's defined by the demand to not think, to just run into action, which is being demanded from you, which I think is the counter of the religious attitude, which I was brought up with, which is, you know, can I have a second opinion? So if I give an example, in a way, if somebody asks me if I'm a Zionist and I hesitate before I answer, that's already perceived as problematic. So it might even more so than if I would say that I wasn't. Sort of like that minute where somebody asks you a question and you say, I want to think about where I am on this, or somebody demands you for an action. I think that's very much part of, our ethical tradition. And I think something which is very missing from today's world, definitely in Israel, and I imagine in other places as well.
Fascinating. Thinking again, like to stop as a country, you know, and to reflect about our decisions.
Yeah.
Michael, I wonder, you know, one of the gifts of speaking with the author is that we can go a little bit beyond the book. And I had two questions that came to me as I was reading this book. You know, the traditions that you mention about the Jews in the before when they live in Europe, in that example. I wonder, how do you see the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel? because in a way they are one of the groups that keep reading this text in a way. I know that we all choose the text. And I just wonder, what do you see there? Because in a way, they never sign on the paper to be Zionist. They look at themselves a little bit different, but also they are part or becoming more part of the state. And also, so this will be one question. And I wonder, what is the dialogue that you have with them? And the second question is, I'm thinking a lot about the diaspora Jews today, like, you know, the second biggest or the equivalent to Israel about the number of Jews is in North America. And I wonder which kind of dialogue you wish Israel would have with American Judaism. Maybe we could share the roles and we could study from each other, which is something that doesn't really happen. And I just wonder where you are with these two questions.
So first, I'm happy of how you posed the question, because there are two issues which I think are maybe oddly not in the book. and I think that's primarily sort of a stylistic choice, I guess. I mean, I felt that I needed to keep focus on, you know, the traditions of the community around, but obviously those two communities, which appear to some extent, but not that much in the book, are obviously need dialogue with, especially I guess the theology. I would say in terms of the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel, it's worth saying that they made a bunch of other choices regarding modernity in general, which makes their option less relevant in terms of how I was brought up. So it's not only a question of nationalism, it's also a question of ultra-Orthodox, you know, post-World War II response to modernity, primarily closing themselves off from the world. I would say particularly in terms of their intellectual interest in things which are happening outside of the community, which I think is a very, it's a very new choice, and one which I don't think that reflects Jewish tradition at all. I mean, there isn't one virtue ethics book in the history, you know, that I'm reading that wasn't directly influenced from religions around it, from its surroundings. You know, the son of, you know, Avraham Maimon from the Egyptian Pietists was, you know, learning from Sufis, and German Pietists were learning from you know, Christians and so on and so forth, and very, very, you know, blatantly so. So in a way, ultra-Orthodox community isn't a relevant option, not because of their choices they made on Zionism, but because of their choices they made in their conversation with the world in general. I would also add that I think what we're seeing today in Israel is that because they haven't been engaged in the last 30 or 40 years intellectually or theologically with giving answers on questions of power. So now when thousands and thousands of young ultra-Orthodox Jews are becoming more Israelis or opening the gates of the ultra-Orthodox community, they're becoming very militantly right-wing. So if you look at sort of, you know, the books which I'm interested in around 1948, which are coming from sort of the ultra-Orthodox leadership, people like Rav Yitzchak Breuer and other leaders who are giving real smart theological responses to Zionism, they don't exist not in the secular ethos, but also not in the ultra-Orthodox ethos. So my frustration, I would say, with ultra-Orthodoxy is not that it chose differently, but rather that it chose not to engage openly and theologically and intellectually. And it basically allows now free reign of the state to take control. What will happen with ultra-Orthodoxy in, you know, the next 20, 30 years, I don't know. But I think there's something missing there, which is a more open conversation on power, which hasn't existed in ultra-Orthodox communities, to the best of my knowledge, at least mainstream Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox for a while. regarding, you know, so-called diaspora Jewry, and so-called because, again, I think we're all in different types of diasporas. Ultimately, I think this is about the recognition of Jewish text and the history of Jewish text as one which we are commanded to. You know, every denomination can have its own understanding of what that means, but one which is our communal language. I feel very comfortable having, you know, religious conversation with anybody around, with any Jew around the world who's interested and who's educated on Jewish texts. It's also, I wrote this book about Israel, but I think, you know, American Jewry also needs to have a reckoning with power. It's a different type of power, maybe more financial, consumerist, and so on and so forth. But I think a lot of the themes that I touch on in the Israeli context should be relevant in other areas to American Jewry, or, you know, European Jewry, or other groups. So that's maybe another answer. And maybe lastly, I would say that there is a national feeling, which I know is not in mode today to say, but Judaism is very much about nation and very much about those distinctions between our community and other communities. And that can be taken and is a lot of times taken to very negative places, but also something which I think is natural. And I feel, you know, when I go to the US, I feel very, and maybe I'll say my father's American. I grew up a bit in the US as well. I have extended family there, but I also feel very comfortable in any synagogue anywhere around the world. I feel home, and I feel at home when I go to that library. And I think that's a very powerful thing.
I think that something that came to me, you know, also as I was reading the book, is that there is, in addition to everything that you mentioned, there is maybe some loss of the engagement between Jews and books.
Yes, yes, for sure. And also, it's the library is never ending, which is something which is so exciting, you know, that because also books get lost and then get found again. And I think that's very, there's something also there, which I find very, you know, because in Israel about the book, I get asked quite a bit about, you know, but who are you writing this for? There are like maybe 10, you know, 10 maybe, you know, religious, you know, folks who are sort of like very committed to that, probably a bit more, but I'm very much in minority in my own community, but that's only if you look at Jewish text, or, you know, horizontally. I mean, there are books which we read today, which are part of our tradition, which weren't very popular when they came out, but there's another sphere even of time and text, which allows you to come back to options which aren't necessarily relevant at some point and then are relevant again at other points. And I think that's something which is very powerful about community and about family, that there is a lineage which you can connect to on various different levels.
I love it. It's like the books that we carry with ourselves in order that maybe our grandchildren will be able to engage with them.
Yeah, and for me, that's why it was important to reconnect with my grandfather's texts. In this case, it's letters, because that's also a tradition which was wiped out, I think, of Israeli consciousness, this Eastern European sort of, you know, Jews who got here. And there were a couple of tens of thousands of them, but they weren't, and they weren't opposed to the Zionist project, but they weren't part of it necessarily. And when they did arrive here, they were considered some sort of relic of the past, which was meant to disappear at some point. And their language all but disappeared, you know, in mainstream culture. I'm talking about, you know, Yiddish, and their political ethos disappeared. And it's important for me to reconnect with them.
Yeah. You know, one of the projects that we are doing, that I'm doing in my work with the Israeli community who lives in the United States, is that we are doing a lot of storytelling. And the fascinating thing is that many of the people have stories about their grandparents, you know, from the Middle East and from North Africa, and that there is grieving about the Jewish Arabic that was lost, and so much knowledge that in a way, because of the project to create a state and to unite us all together, there was also maybe a need or maybe a force to forget what happened before. And yeah. I think that there is a very beautiful today return to the multiply colors and languages and smells that are coming back.
For sure. And that's definitely the case in Israel. And one of the things that excites me most about the book is that I get to hear, without asking, about a lot of people's grandparents, meaning, you know, and it could be, you know, folks who are coming from Middle Eastern backgrounds or from Ethiopian backgrounds or from Eastern European backgrounds. But suddenly and that's one of the frustrations here, because I think if you ask an Israeli to close their eyes and to imagine a religious Jew, they'll probably, unless they're of that themselves, they'll probably imagine a negative stereotype. But if you ask them to imagine their great grandparents, who are also religious Jews, they'll imagine positive stereotypes. So something there is a really depressing disconnect. And in a way, I think the most sort of religious sort of response to what, you know, in our conversation is that I really wanted to present a religious or traditional alternative which people could feel proud of. It's not necessarily about trying to convince people that my tradition is the right tradition, but rather to present a compelling religious alternative which can be perceived as authentic and positive. And I think that's also the role of a religious individual, definitely in modern times when we're in the minority, is to present yourself as a compelling alternative to what we see around, and something which is very lost, I think, in Israeli tradition. And also, I think there is a thirst for it among not only among religious people, or maybe even not specifically among religious people, but among people, you know, who have their own communal traditions that don't mesh with what they see today.
Yes. And I think a lot about the music and the prayers and all the projects that are happening today. I want to go to my last part, the last part of the interview. And I want to be more concrete and to take, if it's okay with you, one example from one of the chapters that you focus, which is about Kibia.
Yes.
Because I think it's a fascinating example where you can see the different choices of different Jewish leaders, Israeli leaders in that time. So Kibia, we speak about the first years of the State of Israel, right?
Yeah.
And there is what we call Fedayun, which are Palestinians who come into Israel and hurting Israelis. They shoot in them and hurt. And the IDF, which was in a very hard place at that time, it's not the IDF that we are aware today, try to do something about the sovereignty of the country.
Yes.
And here I will give it to you. Lead us because here starts the narratives, right?
Yeah. So Kibia is a Palestinian village right beyond the border. I mean, today it's under Israeli control because it's in the West Bank, but it's right beyond what's called the Green Line, which is, you know, the internationally recognized border of Israel. Palestinians who I remember correctly, I think it's Jordanians, not Palestinians, come to Israel one night and commit a terrorist attack. They kill a woman and her son. Israel creates this method through a unit. We won't get too much into it, of reprisal attacks. And then it's unclear exactly what happens in terms of who ordered what. but ultimately almost 70, primarily women and Palestinian women and children, are killed by an Israeli unit as retribution. There are, you know, as this happens, it's an outcry in the world. And because this is one of the first cases post 1948, post the war of 1948, because this is one of the first cases where we have a very public display of what is, you know, can I think be easily perceived as abuse of force. There are a lot of different responses out there to what does it mean that Jews are committing this type of act of violence. And what I look into is are four different responses. The first is to look at how, you know, Ben-Gurion and the military behaved and what they said. I look into religious Zionist responsa, how religious Zionism, you know, and again, should be mentioned, had nothing to do with the actual action, but did support it in retrospect and explain how it actually fits in with, you know, traditional Israeli law. There's a very famous response of Yeshayahu Leibovich, who was an Israeli, a lot of things, but also an Israeli political theologian who talks about the dangers of holiness and power, of using holiness in the sense of power. And maybe the last response, which is the only non-Israeli response, but definitely a Jewish response, which I use, is a beautiful poem by an incredible poet, Jacob Gladstein, who writes about Kibia as being the proof. I mean, the way I read that poem, Kibia as being the proof that nationalism and Judaism just don't work together. And one tradition, the Jewish tradition, the traditional tradition, the diaspora's tradition, basically disappears and allows Israel to take charge. And I look at all four of those examples because all four of those responses, because all of those responses in a way are interesting to me to some extent, but also are missing. I very much identify with the Gladstein, to make a long story short, I very much identify with the Gladstein response, except for one problem, which is that I live here. And just saying, well, I'm not going to be part of this, is really not a moral or responsible option. And for me, that opens the door to trying to figure out how do I basically work in, let's say, a Gladstein framework, but also as an involved Israeli. And also worth mentioning that the classic liberal response is by Leibovich, who basically says, let's take religion out of the public sphere altogether, which is something which I was raised on, to be honest. And I think a lot of religious, liberally inclined religious people in this country are raised on, something that I felt was very significant for me in the past, but a response which I find less compelling for me as time goes by. I think one of the reasons why there isn't a compelling religious left response in this country is because of voices, such dominant voices like Leibovich, which we were all raised on, which basically tell us, don't use your tradition anywhere out of the synagogue because it's dangerous. Yeah. And then we have these beautiful traditions which can actually be very powerful and are supposed to guide us in every aspect of our lives, but we're sort of theologically trained to not use them. Any attempt to use religion in the public sphere is frowned on, you know, by liberal and progressive forces as well, which I think is problematic and makes Israel a problematic case. I mean, in most countries you have, you know, religious pro-equality voices. And in Israel, those voices are less there. And part of that, I think, is because of this tradition that we're not allowed to use that voice in the public sphere. So in a way, this book is both a continuation of the Leibovich model, but also an attempt to challenge it, you know, obviously with love and with a lot of respect, but to also challenge the faults of that tradition, which don't allow a public voice for our beautiful tradition.
I wonder, Michael, maybe today the music is the place that start, we can start hearing these voices, because there is something I feel in the cultural music, I don't know, like voices in Israel and their relationship between Palestinian who are Israeli, like Israeli citizens, and Arabs and Muslim and Jewish, mostly in Jerusalem, that maybe something will change, is changing there?
Yeah, first of all, for sure, and I'm definitely sort of very connected personally to that world. I think, you know, I'm in my day-to-day life, I'm not an academic. These aren't issues. I'm a political activist, but I've always viewed sort of my activism as another form of culture, or another form of you know, the arts.
Yes.
Definitely in terms of liturgy, in terms of music, a lot of things happening. Primarily, I would say, and sometimes I look at somebody from an Eastern European tradition. Sometimes I even look with a bit of envy at what's coming out of beautiful works coming from Middle Eastern communities and from young voices from Middle Eastern. A lot of my friends who are really reconnecting to various aspects of our collective past, primarily through music, also other arts. And for sure, I think all of that is an attempt to find communal beauty, which is not aggressive. And I think there's something there which is very compelling to me, and something which is, as you suggest, very optimistic, because it basically opens up to just a lot of creative fields. So definitely, definitely. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So we will end with, you know, maybe with the title of your book, which called Atchalta, that, you know, you translate it to the dawn of redemption, which is a very complicated and intense word in Jewish theology, because it's like the beginning of, you know, right, bringing the Messiah back and the dreams. But maybe also we just need to read it. And I read it like that. Atchalta, it's a beginning. And your book, for me, was a beginning of theology, Jewish theology, that I think, for me, it was so powerful, and I really hope it will be for many others. So, Michael, thank you so much for writing the book and for joining us to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much. Thank you.